Good morning. I am Robert Mathias, the Managing Director of Ogilvy Washington, and welcome to this morning's Ogilvy Exchange. Today, we look forward to a discussion of technology, social media, and their intersection with American diplomacy. And there is perhaps no one better in the Obama administration or all of government to discuss these themes and issues than Jared Cohen, who serves as a member of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's policy planning staff. Initially brought to Foggy Bottom by then-Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, Jared was kept on to serve in the Obama administration with Secretary Clinton. He currently focuses on counterterrorism, counter-radicalization, Middle East, technology and innovation, public diplomacy and strategic communications, and youth issues. He also chairs the planning staff's working group focused on the 21st century statecraft. Jared has become a specialist in the use of technology to advance American interests throughout the world, particularly in the Middle East and South Asia. In December of 2008, he assembled the first-ever Alliance of Youth Movements, which was a summit of 21st-century movements that relied almost entirely on technology to affect change. In April of 2009, he took senior executives from Silicon Valley on the first-ever U.S. government technology delegation. 8 months later, Cohen brought Google CEO executive Eric Schmidt to Iraq in what was then the first trip to Iraq by an American CEO from any leading American technology company. During June of 2009, he intervened to keep the Twitter network online, delaying scheduled engineering work so that supporters of the Iranian opposition candidate could continue using their network to organize their activities. In December of 2009, CNN released its top 10 Internet moments of the decade, of which Cohen's call to Twitter was among a list that included the launch of Facebook, the introduction of the iPhone, the 2008 presidential campaign, and the Google IPO. In his spare time, Jared is an established author, having recently published two books. He received his BA from Stanford University and his MPhil from Oxford, where he studied as a Rhodes Scholar. Jared will speak for 20 to 30 minutes this morning and then hopefully take questions from all of us. It's my great privilege to introduce Jared Cohen.
Well, thank you for having me this morning. It's a great way to actually start the day. The question, you know, how does technology shape foreign policy is one that only becomes more interesting every single day. Secretary Clinton, in various remarks, has described our foreign policy along three basic pillars: defense, diplomacy, and development. If you look at the first of those, defense, there's a long tradition and institutionalization of an integration of technology and foreign policy. It's everything from, you know, DARPA and the Internet, which Vint and others can talk at better length about than I can, to nanotechnology, to robotics, to traditional technology. But with regards to the other two, diplomacy and development, the integration of technology and foreign policy has in the past been largely based on how do we communicate, message, advocate our policy, a little of dabbling in the open government space, but you know, it's largely been restricted to how do we engage and message and communicate. At the end of the last administration, and in particular in this administration, we're seeking to broaden that and really looking at technology as a tool with broad applicability across the board in our foreign policy. Now, let me begin by giving you the theory of the case and kind of give you a little bit of a sense of how I come at this from some personal experiences, and then give you some examples of what we in the administration are actually doing. I would argue that connection technologies are the most disruptive innovation that we've seen since the invention of the printing press. 5 billion cell phones around the world, 1.7 billion people connected to the Internet. These connection technologies are shaking things up in ways that foreign policy has to adapt to address a whole new set of challenges, as well as take into account an entirely new set of stakeholders that can be engaged, empowered, leveraged, or countered, depending on who they are and what they look like. This is very significant. Now, the notion that, you know, technology is, you know, shaking things up is not necessarily a new phenomenon. The notion that technology is empowering citizens around the world for either good or bad is not a new phenomenon. I mentioned the printing press, but also the radio and the television. Now, I would argue that none of those three, you know, technologies was particularly revolutionary, because each one of the technologies that I mentioned, printing press, the radio and the television, all required intermediaries. So if you were a citizen, to access content, to be part of the distribution of content, to be able to engage with stakeholders who are producing that content, there was an intermediary required, which means that even if a country allowed these technologies in, a country had a greater ability to actually control those intermediaries and thus control the impact of these technologies. With regards to connection technologies like the cell phone and the internet and increasingly cell phones that are internet capable, we're witnessing something that truly is revolutionary because it's the platforms themselves, once created, become the intermediary rather than just the people. And so states, while they can influence by blocking or censoring, they can't fully control unless they're North Korea and never let it in the first place. And so what we're witnessing here is a set of technologies that connect people to information, i.e. new media, that connect people to each other and entities, i.e. social media, and then a whole new element of this, which is technologies that connect people to actual resources, be they financial like mobile banking, judicial like telejustice, education like distance learning, medicine or health like telemedicines, and so on. So technology has not only become a tool with greater utility as a means for empowerment, but it's also the technologies that we see today are really the finest example in history of tools of empowerment that don't require an intermediary. So let me sort of, you know, give you a sense of where I come at this, because there's a very important assumption that we have to start with, which is, you know, as significant as these technologies are, as disruptive as these technologies are, as much as they're shaking things up, the technologies themselves don't choose sides. People do. This is something that Secretary Clinton said during her Internet Freedom speech on January 21st. And so from a foreign policy standpoint, the question is, how do we influence? You know, how do we grapple with this? How do we look at the cost-benefit analysis of, you know, leveraging or distancing ourselves from certain types of technology? And let me just sort of begin by giving you two anecdotes that really kind of shape how I think about this. First one is a collection of photos that I took in Afghanistan. This is from February of 2009. The photos are from inside of Policharki prison. I was in Policharki roughly about 3 months after a prison riot that was orchestrated by a cell within Policharki that had utilized cell phones to orchestrate attacks on three of the ministries in and around Kabul. So from inside of the prison, a number of the inmates had been able to smuggle cell phones in and then utilize those cell phones to orchestrate attacks on the outside. Right? That's actually a frightening scenario in and of itself. When I went to the prison, I was told by the local prison guards that they had fixed the problem and, you know, cell phones were no longer making it into the prisons and, you know, they understood the significance of this and so it wasn't an issue anymore. So they pulled out one of the ringleaders, this gentleman up here, Mullah Akbar Aghi, and asked, you know, if I'd like to sit down and talk to him. And I didn't think he was going to tell me anything particularly interesting, but I really wanted to meet with him so over the course of an hour speaking, I could ask him one final question at the end. Now, my motivation before I tell you what, you know, the question I asked him was in the prison cells where the riots took place, I walked through and I found, you know, all of these notebooks with cell phone numbers. I mean, it was basically like the militant cells' little black books of who knows, you know, what stakeholders out there. And I found all of these concoctions on the ground where they had taken cell phones and radios and made, you know, different types of devices that they used for I have no idea what, but probably something nefarious. And so at the end of our conversation, I asked him, I said, can I have your cell phone number? So imagine all this just so I can ask him one question at the end. And he pulls out an iPhone and gives me his cell phone number. Now, I don't tell you that story because it's particularly prescriptive. It's very anecdotal, but it's sort of one of many stories of how hostile actors are highly innovative and how those who seek to cause us harm and cause those that we want to protect harm are increasingly becoming sophisticated at utilizing these technologies as well as circumventing efforts to stop them from using these technologies. So let me brighten your day a little bit and tell you a different story. I spent a lot of time in Iran before I was in government. One of the most remarkable things happened during my trip there, and it's something that completely shaped how I think about technology on the positive side. I was at a marketplace in one of Iran's busy cities, and I walked into the middle of it, and there was an intersection of about four or five different alleyways. And I saw something truly fascinating, which was a bunch of young people kind of leaning against the wall like this, all tapping away at their phones. Now, it wasn't strange in a country where 67% of the population is under the age of 30 and 60% of the population has access to cell phones to see young people using them. But in this busy intersection, to see so many kids being so antisocial, tapping away at their cell phones against the wall was, you know, something that warranted more questions. So I asked one of them, I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm recruiting a new bassist for my band." I asked another one, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm trying to get a date." I asked, you know, several more of them. They were trying to find out what party was going on that night. You know, it was sort of a range of activities. There wasn't a lot of political activity. Most of it was frivolous and, you know, people would reject as non-substantive. We'll get to that in a second. So I said, "I don't understand. If you're trying to recruit a new bassist, you know, if you're trying to find out what the party is, you know, and you're just sitting here texting, you know, why do it out here in this open alleyway where you're not even getting any sun?" Because it was smack in the middle of winter when I saw this. And they said, "We're using Bluetooth." And now I had always thought of Bluetooth as the creepy earpiece where you walk around talking to yourself. In fact, I saw somebody doing that on the way here and thought he might have been crazy. So they explained, no, you know, they actually weren't familiar with the earpiece aspect of Bluetooth, and I never thought, you know, that's sort of a luxury that facilitates, you know, basic civil liberties that we have. You know, aren't we so lucky that, you know, in our ability to speak freely, we can have an earpiece where we can hold the steering wheel with both hands and not get a ticket in the process? It's not how they think, you know, because there's a different, you know, set of challenges that they have. So they then explained to me, no, Bluetooth allows you to call and text complete strangers as long as they're within, say, you know, 100 yards or so of you. And so, like club promoters, these kids were out there trying to figure out where the party was and just literally texting anybody that went by who showed up on their Bluetooth. Now, imagine if somebody who here is under the age of 30, show of hands. Would you ever do that? Any show of hands, who would actually do that? No, it's creepy, right? You would not do that here. You know, go to your university campus and do that, and you'll be the sort of talk of the town, and not in a good way. And so I asked them, I said, "Aren't you, you know, you're doing this out in public, you know, you're just sort of, you know, almost belligerently, you know, asking people what's going on and trying to get people to do things that they're not supposed to do by law or by norm. Aren't you worried about getting caught?" And they all sort of had crowded around me at this point. They said, "Nobody over 30 knows what Bluetooth is." And so it summed up this very significant generation gap, right? A gap between how young people are using technology and how an older generation is using technology. Now, that's the first significant takeaway I took from this experience. The second significant takeaway I took from this experience is, you know, when I came back to the U.S., I started telling people these stories, and, you know, people said, "So what? They're organizing to sort of, you know, go to underground parties where they make alcohol in bathtubs and sinks and dance to Western music. That means absolutely nothing." And they're right. You know, the substance of that means absolutely nothing. What was significant, and I don't think that I necessarily fully appreciated this at the time, is that take out the substance or lack of substance in what they were doing and look at the tactics. Because of frivolous interests and frivolous motivations, they were learning how to use technology to do things that they're not allowed to do. Then fast forward to June of 2009 or just fast forward to a later period, and all of a sudden those same tactics, when faced with an opportunity, become quite useful in other settings. Which is something we saw in June of 2009 as people use technology as a way to hold the government to account and organize and galvanize. Now, the third one is the most prescriptive, which is I then came back and I started talking to people that have been at the forefront of Bluetooth technology, people at Motorola, people at IBM, experts in the technology industry. And they themselves, when I would tell this story, said, "It can be used for that." So those that have actually been at the forefront of Bluetooth technology failed to actually understand or appreciate not sort of what their innovation was that they created for a largely free and open market, but how their technology would be utilized innovatively by those that needed it for some different purposes. So the analogy for those under 30 in this room is when Facebook was created, they had no idea that this application would be built on top of it called Farmville, which doesn't make sense to a lot of people, but, you know, people spend all sorts of, you know, actual real money and time simulating farm activity on top of a Facebook platform. You know, I've talked to the folks at Facebook about this, and they didn't anticipate that either. Slightly different example, but why is this significant? Well, before we say why it's significant, let's understand why this is the case. I assume everybody in here has cell phones, and everybody in here has a BlackBerry of some kind. By show of hands, how many of you have read the instructions manual? So two people, right? And why would you read the instructions manual? Right, for you, you know, this facilitates basic civil liberties and freedoms that you already have, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly. You don't need to read the instructions manual. You don't need to know how Bluetooth can sort of be utilized to call and text strangers. You don't need to know how to use, you know, application A, B, C, D, E, and F. The difference is, you know, one, you don't have the time to do it. Two, you don't have the reason to do it. You throw something like this into the 31% of the world that's accessing censored internet or living in a censored environment, and all of a sudden you're going to read that instructions manual five times over because you have the time and you have the need. And this becomes your connectivity and the intermediary between you and civil liberties that you might not otherwise have. Go back to what I said at the beginning, that, you know, the intermediaries, different from the days of the printing press, the TV, and the radio, are the platforms. And it's a fixed, you know, once the platforms are created, individuals can influence them, but they can't control them. Or if they can control them, they have to literally cyber attack themselves and attack their own infrastructure and have it all shut down, for which most governments aren't willing to do for longer than a very, very short period of time. So, you know, this is more the, you know, the kind of the optimistic side of it. And, you know, now let's get into what, you know, the actual debate is. You know, I'm not a techno-utopian or tech-utopian or whatever it's called by any stretch of the imagination. I never make claims to suggest that technology is going to save us all, that, you know, just the virtue of technology and the values inherent in it are going to make the world a more stable place. But I am a techno-pragmatist, and let me tell you what that is, because I sort of just started using it a couple weeks ago. To me, a techno-pragmatist accepts the fundamental reality that this isn't DARPA, you know, creating the internet, or Vint creating the internet with DARPA, or whatever sort of combination it was. This is the reality is that whether we like it or not, you know, from a policy standpoint, Microsoft, Google, Cisco, Oracle, Facebook, you know, all these different companies are putting these tools out on the public domain. You know, it's not, you know, it's just, that's just the nature of commerce and, you know, a 21st century market. And so from a government standpoint, we have two options. We can fear that we can't control it and thus not try to influence it. And by the way, if we don't try to influence it, all that does is give greater space and greater room to hostile actors who seek to use technology for nefarious purposes. Or we can recognize that the 21st century is a terrible time to be a control freak, recognize that we can't control it, but we can influence it. And there's no better time to influence it than when access is where it is today versus, say, when cell phone penetration is 80% or 85% or internet penetration is 60% or 70%, because, you know, we can actually be involved in bringing access under the auspices of education and health and very substantive activities. I had taken a trip to Herat province in northwestern Afghanistan in, I think it was March of 2009, and I saw something remarkable. Herat province, which borders with Iran, has more, you know, cell towers and electricity towers than just about any other part of Afghanistan that I'd seen. And right next to each one was an Iranian-funded school, an Iranian-funded mosque, an Iranian-funded charity. And so Afghanistan's neighbor saw the utility in bringing access on their terms. You know, and so it's, you know, I sort of point to that as an important case study. Now, for those that are still skeptical, I point to historic analogy. During the Cold War, we said the very same thing about the cassette tape. Remember Walkmans with cassette tapes. We didn't want to support the cassette tape or even take advantage of this technology or go anywhere near it, because we feared that embracing the utility of this technology as something with a net positive, even though there were certain costs to it, wasn't worth the risk. And so failing to appreciate the fact that this was a private sector company or a collection of private sector companies innovating Walkmans and cassette tapes, we backed away. And not only did the Soviets use cassette tapes to propagate the communist ideology that we so feared throughout Central Asia and elsewhere, but an unanticipated consequences. Had it not been for the cassette tape, it's very unlikely that Ayatollah Khomeini from his villa in France would have been able to achieve the kind of notoriety that allowed him to come back to such fanfare in Iran in February of 1979. So that's a very important historic case study. So, you know, when I say I'm a techno-pragmatist, what I mean by that is these technologies are out there. Again, what I said at the beginning is they're shaking things up in ways that are good and bad. And from a foreign policy standpoint, there's no better time or no better opportunity than engage now when this education gap, or sorry, when this generation gap exists, when the innovation gap that I mentioned exists before, where there's a high amount of energy on the part of the private sector, even wanting to understand how its technologies can be utilized or are being utilized. And so we're in this unique moment of time where we have maybe 5 to 7 to 10 years to really embrace this space. And so This is very much what the debate looks like. Now, Secretary Clinton is a huge proponent of leveraging innovation, unlocking the power of connection technologies as a tool of connection technologies. But neither she nor the administration is so naive as to think that, you know, there's not a certain risk that comes with engaging in this space. And so we're venturing into a foreign policy that takes into account these technologies and leverages these technologies, but not without full consideration for what they actually do. Now, that's rarely going to leave us to make the calculation that a technology that's out there anyway and growing is something that we should ignore. It's a new space for us. It's part of why it's so important for us to engage outside of the building, in academic circles, in the private sector circles, and it's a huge reason and motivation behind bringing in an entirely new set of stakeholders that haven't been part of foreign policy before. The world doesn't look like this anymore. So let me tell you sort of how this is all playing out based on, the techno-pragmatist conclusion. Unless you're North Korea, and that's a satellite image of the Korean Peninsula at night, and never let the technology in the first place, there's very few cement walls that exist. You have your block sites and so forth, but that's not a cement wall. That's a porous wall. It's very different. What the world looks like today is rather than a world in which people needed chisels and hammers and axes to pound through a cement wall and find out what was on the other side and create space for, grassroots, individuals and entities to come into the other side. Today what you have is, again, with the exception of North Korea, is a series of porous walls. Now, some walls, firewalls, are more porous than others. Some are pretty fixed with just sort of an occasional hole here and there. But it's innovation that is kind of the modern day chisel. It's innovation that is the modern day axe. And as smart as people and engineers are out in Silicon Valley and in the technology industry, even they can't imagine how the tools that they innovate will be utilized innovatively, as I illustrated with the example before. But there's another interesting piece. I just mentioned a second ago that it wasn't until the Berlin Wall came down that we really saw a flooding of NGOs and civil society organizations into the Eastern Bloc. Today that's very different because private sector companies, like all the ones that I listed before, are increasingly taking on grassroots qualities, whether they like it or not. Now, they could be a company that is entirely and exclusively focused on making money and not on mission. It could be the most, that could be entirely what their focus is. Still, if they're creating tools that can be utilized as a tool for empowerment, again, for good or for bad, that's a technology that is increasingly available behind some of these firewalls. And so what we're seeing is civil society actually looking very, very different than ever before. It used to be that civil society was the ones with the NGOs or the few collection of stakeholders, and thus where you saw the greatest walls or in this day and age. Firewalls, you see the least, prevalence of organized civil society, organized opposition, organized dissent. Now, with 5 billion people around the world having access to cell phones, anybody with a cell phone has the potential to be an empowered citizen, again, for good or for bad. That can be an empowered citizen to conduct acts of terror. That can be an empowered citizen to, hold a government to account or promote transparency or human rights or women's empowerment, right? So, again, I keep mentioning both the positive side and the negative side because part of our job from a foreign policy standpoint is to recognize that it can be either, and where statecraft comes in is recognizing that, in the 21st century, statecraft is as much about building connections as it is doing negotiations. And so with that in mind, one of the things we try to do is identify old and new challenges and bring in a multifaceted set of stakeholders, experts on the tools, i.e. the technology industry, experts on the issue, i.e. civil society, government, who can be an honest broker and convene and connect them all, and extract value from a set of stakeholders that aren't used to actually engaging with each other. So I'm going to get back to more of this in a second, but I want to give you a little kind of historical background of where this all began. I can pinpoint to you the exact day that, at least in my, 4 years working in government, 2.5 in the previous administration, and a year and some change in the new administration, when technology, first made it onto the map outside of defense and outside of traditional sort of communication and policy advocacy. I came to work on February 5th, 2008, then Deputy Secretary of State and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice had read in, I think it was the Wall Street Journal, about these massive protests in Colombia. And something about how Facebook and Skype and MSN were utilized as a tool in those protests. And they asked me, you know something about these tools. I mean, this is a point where people were calling it MyFace instead of Facebook. I mean, there was like a lot of confusion as to what these things actually were, and a lot of skepticism. You know, because frankly speaking, there hadn't been a successful case study of high magnitude of these tools being utilized to make a positive impact. So I called down to our ambassador in Colombia, and I said, can you put me in touch with the organization that led these protests? Because it was significant. It was the largest protest against a terrorist organization in history. There were 12 million people in 190 cities around the world protesting against the FARC, which was a 40-plus-year-old terrorist organization. So this was very, very significant. The embassy came back to me after about an hour and said it was leaderless. It was spontaneous. You know, there was nobody in charge. And I said, that's not possible. So in what I'm certain was the very first diplomatic outreach via an online social network, I signed on to my Facebook account and started looking up different groups and, had one of our interns sort of help me out. And we found this group called Million Voices Against FARC, which had, roughly, about 600,000 members in it. And I saw the creator was this guy named Oscar Morales. Now, I assumed Oscar was a seasoned, civil society activist that had been funded through a variety of U.S. government grantees or non-U.S. government grantees, well-educated, experienced, trained all over the world. He came back. So I sent him a message. I said, I'm with the State Department. I'd like to come down to Colombia and meet you. His response to me was, really? And I said, yes, really, I'd like to come and meet with you. He said, why? I said, well, I want to know how you did this. And he said, really? And I said, yes, I want to know how you did this. And so I flew down to Colombia, and Oscar had never been to the U.S. Embassy before. He'd never met anybody in the U.S. government or any government for that matter. He was an unemployed engineer from Barranquilla. He hadn't had a job in several years. He lived in a tiny studio apartment. He just sort of woke up one day and decided that a particular kidnapping that happened was just too much and he had enough, and he came up with a very simple slogan, No Mas FARC, which was something easy for people to get their head around. And so I asked him, I said, how did you do it? And I was surprised to find he started building the organization a month before the protest. So in 1 month, imagine this, in 1 month he was able to build an organization that put 12 million people in the streets in 190 cities around the world. So naturally, again, I'm thinking, he must have gotten some kind of special training. And he didn't. He said, I came up with this message, and I didn't think it was going to grow to be something that big, so I figured everybody that joins, I'll make an officer. And so it was very easy, right? It started off as, country leaders and city leaders and municipal leaders and then a PR team. And then as it grew to thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands, it became, so his group had 300,000 more employees than AT&T, which is 300,000 employees. And, he had this vision that the digitally connected few could galvanize and mobilize the non-connected masses because word of mouth networks remain the primary tool for civil society organizing. So, he had to get really creative. He developed an anti-hacking brigade. They developed a constitution, a Supreme Court. I think they even had an appeals court at one point. I mean, it was literally like the most sophisticated NGO I've ever seen in my entire life. People said, well, this isn't an NGO. And I said, why not? What are the characteristics of an NGO? To me, this has a URL and a website instead of an office. It has followers and members instead of a paid staff. And it uses open source platforms instead of applying for grants at various entities that and foundations that hand them out. So what characteristics of an NGO is this missing other than the fact that it looks a little bit different? And this is an important question because this is a question that's ongoing. What do these things look like? Can a viral video be an NGO? Can a Facebook group be an NGO? This era where, you don't just have NGOs or traditional grassroots movements that are increasingly using technology, you have, a whole new horde of civil society stakeholders that actually wouldn't exist without technology. Or it's not that they wouldn't exist as sort of, human flesh, but you wouldn't know about them without technology. And so the first fascinating thing that Oscar told me is kind of how he did this. The second most fascinating thing he told me was the day after they did it, because I went down a couple months afterwards, and the day after they did it, they started getting messages from people in Venezuela and Iran and China, all over the world, wanting to know how they did it. So organically, there was this sort of public proof of concept, this kind of net positive. So when people talk about, for instance, Iran, right, they say, well, you know, all these people use technology, you know, use technology to go to the streets, and it didn't do anything. The election results remain the same. I would argue that there was a huge benefit and a huge victory in terms of what happened, which is, you know, these are global challenges. They're not just challenges in Iran or one place or another place. You know, people in Iran showcased how technologies can be used in the face of politically motivated censorship and put a whole bunch of best practices and additional set of challenges out on the public domain that are now being troubleshooted and or utilized by a variety of stakeholders around the world. That, to me, is a net positive. The same way we look at the internet as one internet, not a series of intranets, we should also look at, you know, a new kind of 21st century civil society as something where the innovation of one can be utilized by many, or the troubleshooting of one can be utilized by many. So I came back and I was, you know, over the moon. I was like, this is so cool. You know, this guy used Facebook. He sort of built this gigantic organization. And there came the skeptics, you know, and said, well, yeah, but how do we know it was really the technology that did this? You know, and you know, how do we know that it even had an impact? Well, let's start with the impact of just the protests themselves. The 2 weeks that followed these protests saw the largest number of demobilizations and desertions from the FARC in its 40-plus year history. So, you know, if you look at our struggle against violent extremism, the struggle that the Colombians have been having against violent extremism against the same set of stakeholders is far longer than what we've been experiencing since 9/11 or even since the 80s. And so that was very significant. And why, you know, why did this happen? Well, all these people that have been fighting in the jungle with the FARC, until they saw all of their compatriots in Colombia and around the world protesting, they had thought that they were on the winning side. And any attempts to make them think that they were on the winning side was viewed as government propaganda. So people were still skeptical, right? Again, that doesn't answer the question of how technology, you know, maybe these protests, maybe they used technology, but was technology really behind, you know, the phenomenon that created space that gave rise to unlikely leaders. And so then Undersecretary of State Jim Glassman and I went down to Colombia and we met with President Uribe, because, you know, who better to ask than the person that's been leading the charge against the FARC. And we asked him, was technology significant? And President Uribe said, had it not been for technology, you would not have had space for untainted civil society leadership. The reason that these sorts of protests hadn't been able to be built in the past are because, every single organization takes money from somebody, is affiliated by somebody, has some sort of hand that feeds them. Nobody knew who these people were, and by the time they figured it out, the protests had already happened. And even when they did figure it out, it's not like you could sort of Google search these people. You know, it's not like these people had any background. It was just sort of a random group of unlikely leaders. And I would argue that, you know, we now should shift, you know, we called them unlikely because they were sort of not what we typically viewed as a leader, but they're actually more the more common leader than the more traditional ones that we're used to. We're seeing, you know, we don't necessarily acknowledge them as your kind of modern day leader because they don't fit our historical context, but they are. So there's an important piece here, which is, you know, what's the symbiotic relationship between the traditional leaders, those we train in those NGOs, and the non-traditional leaders, i.e. the ones that technology creates space for? Well, the problem is after Oscar did this, he tried to build an organization, an actual traditional organization, and it failed. He didn't know how to do it. And so what these 21st century leaders understand is technology and how to organize events and movements around a particular cause or a particular event or in response to something. With the tradition, I would argue that, you know, still the traditional types of organizations and movements should be at the epicenter of civil society because they are the ones who are trained, they're the ones that understand the issues, they're the ones that, you know, will emerge as future leaders of the country. But I would argue that they can't do it alone in the 21st century. That the traditional set of civil society organizations and NGOs, they have this expertise and this background, but they need a good 21st century kick in the ass. That is, they need to figure out how to utilize these new tools so that they can reach a broader audience, be more effective, scale up and amplify what they're doing. And so one of the things we're working to do is to better map and cohere, convene and connect and build marriages between traditional elements of civil society and non-traditional elements of civil society. So let me give you another example. Neda Sultan, who was killed in the midst of the demonstrations in Iran in June of 2009. I don't know who initially captured the video of Neda being killed on their cell phone. I don't know if they were male, female, rich, poor, involved in the protests, just walking by, politically motivated, not politically motivated, you know, knew her or didn't know her. I know nothing, nor does anybody know anything about who the individual was that got this video out there. Let's start with what we do know. What we do know is that within hours, this video made it onto the desks and into the brains of some of the most powerful and least accessible people on the planet. Heads of state, presidents, prime ministers, kings, queens, you name it. Some of the most powerful private sector leaders around the world. Some of the most powerful thought leaders around the world. And this image, this video, you know, galvanized a world around an issue. I don't think anybody would dispute the fact that this video made it on the street to some of the least accessible people on the planet. And people started to change their rhetoric. All around the world, we saw leaders changing their rhetoric. It wasn't just that it made it onto their desk. It made it onto the desk, and then the entire world was watching. It was almost like, metaphorically, the entire world was standing outside of their offices waiting to know what they were going to say. So it was getting it onto their desk, but in a way that held them accountable to actually say something. And so this video had an actual, global policy impact in terms of, leaders around the world, responding to it and commenting on it and condemning the act of violence. Let's do a little counterfactual. Let's take video-capable cell phones out of Iran. Would the world know about Neda Sultan? Would heads of state be commenting on Neda Sultan, within hours? Would, at a very, very contentious moment, people, feel compelled to respond? Would there be this global outcry? What you would have had is a bunch of NGOs who would have been under tremendous scrutiny trying to, recount, what they saw, or trying to get people to look at what they saw. And I'm not going to answer the question for you, but ask yourself the question: without video-capable cell phones, would this incident have had the kind of impact that it did? I think I know what your answer would be. Haiti. Let's go to a different kind of example. The interesting thing about Haiti is, the earthquake happens January 13th, 2010. In November of 2009, I took Eric Schmidt and a few other executives from Silicon Valley to Iraq. And the purpose of our trip was to look at lessons learned on how technology could have been utilized early on in the post-conflict reconstruction. So, for instance, in Iraq, we didn't necessarily anticipate that cell phones would massively outpace landlines, and as such, we spent a lot of early money investing on low orbit satellite and dial-up connection as opposed to 3G connection. That would have been sort of a better thing to understand earlier, but it was just sort of the nature of the technology. We were looking at things like this. We came away with a whole variety of conclusions about how technology could play a valuable and constructive role in post-conflict reconstruction. Never in my, by any stretch of the imagination would I have made a connection between what we were looking at there and what we were looking at in Haiti, until the earthquake happened, and Anne-Marie Slaughter, who's the director of the policy planning staff, asked me to co-lead a task force that looked at how technology can be utilized in the aftermath of the earthquake. And I did two things. First thing was I got in touch with our ambassador in Indonesia to ask if there were any lessons learned from the tsunami in terms of how technology could have been utilized, and he gave me a whole bunch of ideas. The second thing I did was look at my notes from my trip to Baghdad with Eric and realized, post-conflict reconstruction and post-disaster reconstruction actually look very similar. Law and order, preservation of law and order is important. Saving lives is important. Getting infrastructure, giving aid organizations the ability to communicate on the ground is important. And so, we had all these prescriptions from just a couple months ago in a completely different context on a completely different issue that we started to utilize in Haiti. Now, we made it a priority early on to get the telecommunications up and running again because, aid organizations which were pulling bodies out of the rubble and which were doing a lot of the immediate, saving lives work needed to be able to coordinate with each other. And so it's not that telecommunications was taking away from, the immediate task of saving lives. It's that telecommunications and technology, empowered those entities and individuals doing this on the ground to do it more effectively and not duplicate. And then we all know about the Text Haiti to 9099 campaign. We raised, close to $35 million entirely by text donations for the Red Cross in just, it was just the first week. Afghanistan. This is one of my favorite case studies. And I'll actually end with this one, even though there's a lot more that I can discuss because I really want to get into interesting questions and answers. Afghanistan is the only country in the entire world where police officers or any law enforcement entities are receiving their salaries over cell phones. Now, that's remarkable to me, but at the same time, it isn't, because I'm a believer in the fact that if you want to know where the greatest innovation is happening, look in the places that face the greatest challenges. So you have to ask yourself the question, how is it that in a in a country where 97% of the population doesn't have access to a bank account, where 1% of the population has the internet, and roughly 27 to 30% of the population has access to cell phones, it is the only country on the world for all the innovation engineering out there that's giving that's paying police officers their salaries over cell phones. Well, you know, the telecommunications companies kept having their towers blown up in Helmand, Ghazni, and Kandahar. Why were the cell phone towers getting blown up? Well, because there was nobody protecting them. Why was nobody protecting them? Well, the police were deserting or abandoning because they weren't getting their salaries on time, or they weren't getting them in their entirety, and then when they did get them, they had to desert their post for a couple weeks to go deliver the salaries to their family. So the telecommunications companies, you know, got their heads around this issue and said, well, what if we can get them their salaries on time in their entirety and they can transfer them instantaneously to their families? Well, you know, that wasn't going to happen through formal banking systems. So, they adopted a system that was built in Kenya called M-Pesa, which is a mobile money transfer program, which allows people to, which has these agents that people use as cash in and cash out points, and people can literally have a bank account. And even a literate population. So then a lot of, you know, the police officers they were finding, you know, weren't getting their salaries, or thought they weren't getting their salaries. And they realized it's because a number of them were illiterate. So they incorporated a voice-activated system, so you only need to know the numbers 1, 2, and 3, and, you know, the voice-activated system allows you to kind of navigate it and still utilize it. Ambassador Holbrooke's office has really been at the forefront of innovating in this space in terms of convening the right sets of stakeholders to identify projects like this and you know, not just scale them up, but also make them known to other parts of the foreign policy apparatus, because this has broader applicability than just, you know, than just Afghanistan. So, for instance, we're looking at, you know, building out a similar platform in the Congo, so that the Congolese army can be paid. So that way they, you know, have a greater incentive to protect women who are experiencing sexual and gender-based violence in the East, in the Eastern Congo. But the reason I tell you this sort of somewhat long-winded story is the reasons why this exists in Afghanistan are very important. Nobody sort of raised their hand and said, this would be great to do in Afghanistan. It was an innovation that arose out of necessity. When Safaricom and Vodafone got together to build out the M-Pesa program in Kenya, they didn't realize that it could be used for something like this because there wasn't the same need for it that there was, say, in a place like Afghanistan, because for their mobile interests, their towers weren't threatened. And that was the origins of this. And so let me leave you with just sort of one final point, and then we'll go to questions and answers, which is from a statecraft standpoint. Go back to what I said before, that statecraft is in the 21st century, statecraft is as much about building connections as it is doing negotiations. The U.S. government has one set of tools. We're probably the world's greatest matchmaker, or we're uniquely positioned to be the world's greatest matchmaker. But to address 21st century challenges, we need 21st century tools. And we're not shy about saying that we are not the experts on innovation. But, you know, people at private sector companies are experts on innovation. Civil society organizations are experts on local contacts, you know. And so what we're trying to do is put the pieces together so we have all the expertise in one room troubleshooting the same challenges. Because to me, statecraft is basically a fancy way of saying troubleshooting. And if you think about troubleshooting anything, you want as many experts in the room helping you troubleshoot your challenges, whether it's computer troubles or geopolitical troubles, as possible. And that's very much how we're thinking about 21st century statecraft. Thanks.
Thank you all. We'll go to Q&A in just a second. If you all would help our friends from C-SPAN out, but when you have a question, please wait for the boom mic to come to you. Identify yourself and your organization and ask your question clearly and slowly. Thank you.
Do you want me to, Finn, why don't you start?
Wait for the boom. Okay. My name's Vince Cerf. I work at Google. And my question for you, Jared, first of all, thank you. That was absolutely wonderful. I've never taken this many notes in such a short amount of time. You mentioned that the technologies that enable all of this are personal, effectively, and they don't require any intermediaries, unlike the printing press and so on. Let me disagree in the following sense. There is an intermediary that links those personal technologies to everyone else, and that's the Internet service providers or the mobile phone carriers. They become targets, in some sense, of government concern and maybe even control and intervention. So I guess I'd like to hear a little bit more about what you think about that potential bottleneck.
No, I think that's actually a really valid point, and I don't actually disagree with that, Vint. You know, it's you know, in the free and sort of open world where there isn't censorship. I think this isn't an issue so much domestically, but it is an issue as we begin to engage technology companies as a new sort of stakeholder in our foreign policy, right? So companies, you know, have to kind of balance between, you know, how involved or not they want to be involved with you know, foreign policy. But NGOs make the same calculations, right? So remember what I said, that technology companies, whether they like it or not, are increasingly taking on NGO-esque characteristics. And there's NGOs out there that, you know, want to work with us, don't want to work with us, want to work with us quietly, don't want to work with us quietly, are willing to take U.S. government money, are not willing to take U.S. government money, are willing to work in country A but not country B. Same calculation that I think that private sector companies are going to have to make. And I think I've encountered this a fair amount. There's some mobile, companies by virtue of what they do for profit or for mission, you know, from our standpoint are putting out very useful and arguably contentious tools on the public domain. And so we'd be crazy to not engage them to learn more about how these tools are utilized, but we'd also be crazy not to engage them to figure out how we can effectively leverage them to produce net positive outcomes. And, you know, like, you know, any other element of civil society of which the private sector is now part of, you know, sometimes the conversation results in something, sometimes it doesn't. You know, the U.S. government isn't in the business of telling companies, you know, what to do, at least from the State Department side. You know, on the regulation side, if they're you know, violating laws, that's a different story. But from our standpoint, what we're in the business of is having conversations and facilitating conversations and partnering as equal stakeholders when possible. Now, with regards to international companies, this is a very, very much more difficult issue. So in countries where there's a lot of censorship, in countries where, you know, there's greater concern about these technologies and where either the governments or non-state actors are exploiting or utilize these technologies to cause harm, the companies themselves are under great risk. So again, so they're faced with this reality that, you know, the tools they innovate are being used for good and for bad. That's the reality that they're forced to contend with, same reality that we in the government are forced to contend with. So then their question is not just how do we, you know, have it be a net positive, but how do we actually continue to make money and not have hostile actors go after our offices, not have a government raid our offices, not get shut down, you know, because at the end of the day, we have shareholders and we have a board and we have a business to run. So it's a different set of calculations that the private sector has to have. I think they're working through this. I think it's a case-by-case basis. In fact, I don't think I can give you a sort of definitive answer that here's the formula. In some countries, you know, companies are more willing to do it than others. I think oftentimes it depends on the personality. And some individuals are willing to take greater risks than others, the same way some activists are willing to take greater risks than others, and I think it depends. One point that I do want to make, which is somewhat related, but I think it's important, you know, I oftentimes will say something that's very controversial, which is nobody gets arrested for blogging. People get arrested for dissent. And, you know, a blog getting shut down is no different than a reformist newspaper office getting raided and their editor-in-chief getting dragged out of the office. The office just sort of looks different. The editor-in-chief just looks a little bit different. And so these are sort of some of the same trends and phenomenon that I think private sector companies have to grapple with.
I'm Michael Nelson. I'm a professor of Internet Studies at Georgetown, and I've been working with our Institute for the Study of Diplomacy on this broad question of what we call iDiplomacy. We're looking at how diplomats use the technology, how governments talk to foreign publics, how we can foster people-to-people communications on Facebook and the like. I'm curious whether you've identified other countries around the world that are moving as aggressively in this area as State Department or international or intergovernmental organizations that you look to for advice or further examples.
Yeah, I mean, actually, you know, did everybody hear the question? This is sort of the next phase of this. So my colleague Alec Ross and I have been kind of grappling with this a lot lately. And for those that don't know Alec is the first senior advisor for innovation that we've ever had at the State Department. It's a tremendous creation in terms of having somebody show leadership, somebody being able to drive the leadership on innovation. And so Alec is really uniquely positioned in this new role to have conversations with ministers and allies around the world. And so, that's one track, the sort of straight up, just sort of government to government diplomatic track. But the other piece of this is, you know, the U.S. is not the only, you know, hub of technological innovation around the world. So take a place like Russia. Right, so Russia is home to some of the best software engineers and technological innovation in the world. And you know, during the Cold War, we viewed innovation as a zero-sum game, where if Russia innovated, it came at the expense of us. If we innovated, it came at the expense of them. Now, as we look to the official policy of, you know, resetting relations between the U.S. and Russia, you know, we would argue, you know, part of that is throwing in a little, you know, mix of tech and innovation, because it's a great opening, right? It's something, it's a resource, it's probably our best shared resource. And so we're having conversations with the Russians under the auspices of, you know, a bilateral innovation dialogue called the U.S.-Russia Innovation Dialogue on how technology can be utilized to empower civil society to address health and education, anti-corruption, anti-trafficking, and it's leading to really vibrant, not just conversations, but actual initiatives. India is another one. India is here right now for the strategic dialogue. You know, there's few countries in the world that are leading on innovation the way India is, and they're a very, very obvious partner. It's not just that our technology companies and platforms can be utilized and beneficial to, you know, civil society in India or the Indian government. Their technological platforms and innovations can also be useful tools that we can use here in the United States. And by the way, the tools that we innovate, you know, separately or together can be useful tools that we can lead on together in terms of pushing them out globally to be utilized by civil society. So the short answer to your question is this is sort of phase two. So phase, you know, we're sort of, I use the metaphor of we're a startup in the foreign policy apparatus right now. We've moved from the metaphorical garage to, you know, to small offices on University Avenue in Palo Alto. And, you know, we haven't yet, but we're, you know, we're still a pre-IPO company, you know, to sort of continue the metaphor. And so there's a lot of work to do. But I think this is the next phase. Is there a question in the back? That's an excellent question, and I would say the most, maybe one of the most important technologies to hit the U.S. State Department in terms of from an efficiency standpoint are BlackBerries. When the incident happened in Honduras, I'm trying to remember, this was maybe 6-7 months ago, maybe I can't remember how long ago it was. One of the things that we saw early on is everybody in the negotiations, not just on our side, but on the various Latin American sides, had BlackBerries. And our then Assistant Secretary of State, Tom Shannon, sort of observed that, you know, this created a remarkable amount of efficiency because people actually could speak definitively and get real-time answers from their host governments, and it just led to a very honest, frank, and efficient negotiation and discussion. And I keep hearing this every time there's a sort of critical negotiation or a critical juncture that involves multiple stakeholders who, you know, aren't at presidential or cabinet or even minister level stakeholders. These BlackBerries are this, you know, incredible link to the nerve system of respective governments that allow negotiations to take place in a really remarkable way. You know, that's sort of obvious, but you know, BlackBerries have only entered into the State Department really in the last couple of years, last 2 or 3 years. So this is actually a really remarkable thing. Before that, we had cell phones and we had FOBs, for which we actually had to go to, you know, computers and log in and all of that. So this is actually, I mean, that's probably the best example that I can give you. But we have a lot of great people at the State Department from our e-diplomacy shop to our public diplomacy shop really working hard to figure out how to use these technologies, not just on the foreign policy side, but how we can actually make ourselves work better and more efficient.
Any observations for other countries or international?
I think a lot of so here's what we're seeing right now. We're seeing a lot of interest. You know, we've definitely seen the same thing we know that other countries have experienced the same sort of BlackBerry phenomenon where they're just, you know, everybody's just sort of dumbfounded that we didn't have this a couple of years ago and how much easier and how many crises could have been averted by getting answers on time and so forth. Maybe treaties would have been signed. But it's one of the things I'm really ecstatic about is, you know, even countries where we sometimes, you know, where the relationship sort of, you know, oscillates a little bit between very friendly and turbulent, this is actually a conversation that is very easy to have with just about any stakeholder. Even countries that censor their internet, this still provides an opening for us to talk about things. So, you know, under the auspices of conversations about technology, you can have conversations about human rights, civic empowerment, a variety of other things. And so I often use this phrase that technology is both a carrot and a stick, right? The carrot being there's very few countries around the world that don't want technological investment in their country. There's very few countries around the world that don't want things to be more efficient and work better. And for that, they need technology stakeholders. Well, one of the virtues of having technology stakeholders increasingly view their role as broader than just commercial is to increasingly find ways to get them to take off their commercial hat and put on diplomatic hats. And so in this sense, technology, you know, we sort of talk about track two diplomacy sometimes, where we're sort of, you know, non-state stakeholders play a role in facilitating, you know, conversations to troubleshoot kind of age-old challenges. I view, you know, I'd like to sort of throw out there another term, which is track 2.0 diplomacy, where the platforms can actually bring together stakeholders for one purpose, but actually result in deeper conversations than just the commercial value of these technologies. Back there. No, it's an excellent question. You can't go from zero to 60, right? So, you know, and so there's a couple reactions I have. So let's first just sort of look at this question of, you know, senior officials blogging, getting out there and using technology more, you know, is it being effective? You know, is it going to be more? It's all cumulative, right? Everybody's learning from each other's best practices. Everybody's figuring out how to get more Twitter followers, how to, you know, utilize social networking platforms and so forth. I mean, 3 years ago, you could not have had a conversation with anybody in any arm of the U.S. government about doing this at an embassy level. You couldn't even have that conversation. Now, just about every ambassador and embassy is on Facebook, on Twitter. They're sort of entering phase two of figuring out how to use it more effectively. You know, they're starting to use Google Translate. You know, I mean, they're using a lot of these tools that are out there. But again, go back to what I said at the beginning. The easy part of all of this is figuring out how we leverage these technologies as a tool to communicate, message, you know, get our senior officials out there. And don't get me wrong, that is extremely important. But that's only one slice of the pie, right? Technology is a tool that should be part of everything we do, from, you know, non-proliferation to anti-trafficking to education to health to various forms of development. There's literally not a single foreign policy challenge out there that technology can't be used in some way, shape, or form to help address. And, you know, while it's important to focus on the parts that we all get, it's also important not to neglect the parts that we still struggle to understand. Well, to start with, I would argue that those are conversations that wouldn't have taken place 5 years ago, right? And so, you know, I'm going to keep going back to this idea that we can't go from zero to 60. Secretary Clinton did something remarkable in January of this year, which is she elevated internet freedom to be a major foreign policy priority. She delivered a major policy address that was 40, 45, you know, plus minutes on the issue of internet freedom. It has never been given that kind of attention at that level before, ever. And part of the reason she did it was, over the past sort of year or two, from Iran to Moldova to Egypt to China to Vietnam, all over the world, she was watching activists take their advocacy for human rights and democracy and civic empowerment from traditional realms and increasingly take them into cyberspace. The logic was, if cyberspace is merely an extension of the traditional civil society realms, we know, not some sort of strange place where bad things happen to good people and bad people do bad things for nefarious purposes, then what it means is that our policies that govern how we protect, how we engage, how we empower the traditional set of stakeholders in the traditional realm should also be extended into cyberspace. And she made a very bold move that, you know, had a tremendous impact in terms of elevating that issue. So when the Secretary of State delivers a major policy address, what that means is that's then on the table. So conversations about internet freedom with a variety of stakeholders that wouldn't have taken place before are now taking place. You know, there's no way to hide the fact that she elevated the issue and did so, you know, very comfortably and in a very effective manner. And so, you know, before you can actually have the conversations lead to the kinds of, you know, 60 mile per hour outcomes that you want to see, the conversations have to take place in the first place. And her elevating this issue has brought out of the woodwork a whole variety of stakeholders that didn't know if this was something that was important. So, you know, a lot of the solutions are going to come from engineers that don't care about human rights necessarily. You know, some do, some don't, but, you know, care a lot about coding and never really thought about the link between coding and protecting human rights, but they saw something on TV and it struck a particular nerve, and all of a sudden they're coding proxy and circumvention technology. Another thing that was significant in that in the speech was a policy shift where, you know, look, we've long supported you know, proxy and circumvention technology to help people get around politically motivated censorship, but it's something that we're much more comfortable talking about now. You know that's a very, very new paradigm shift. You know, that wherever people around the world face politically motivated censorship, Secretary Clinton mentioned in her speech that we will look for opportunities to empower entities that are working to help them circumvent that. You know, that is the same, you know, the idea behind that is rooted in the same, you know, policies that govern how we protect human rights activists. And so I would argue we're making progress every day. You know, we're now not just having the conversations government to government, but the conversations are becoming multi-stakeholder conversations. They're becoming very public conversations. Private sector companies are beginning to see their shared responsibility in this. A lot of them are grappling with these issues. There's, you know, certainly a pressure for companies to think about the impact that their policies have on the well-being of individuals in a variety of countries. But it's important not to single out China in this. You know, we believe in one internet, and as much as the media was obsessed with the whole Google China phenomenon, we looked at that as a valuable opportunity to, you know, take the media's interest and, you know, have a global conversation about internet. We don't have an internet freedom policy towards one country or another. We have a global internet freedom policy. We, you know, support, you know, efforts to get around politically motivated censorship globally. You'd be hard pressed to figure out actually ways to do that are single country specific. And so when the media was obsessed with this issue of Google and China, it provided a great opportunity to talk about, you know, the girl in Saudi Arabia who was murdered by her father in an honor killing because he caught her using Facebook. It was an opportunity to talk about censorship in Tunisia. It was a great opportunity to talk about some of the activists around the world that are, you know, facing harsh critique or repercussions because they're speaking their mind. And so it's we all have to remember it's broader than just, you know, one company in one country. Oh, okay, right here. Yeah, I mean, I don't have a clear answer for you, in part because these are things that we're still thinking about, right? Remember, everyone has, this policy, you know, this sort of prioritization of internet freedom is less than a year old. It's actually significantly less than a year old. And so it's actually forums like this where we hear people's questions that actually are some of the most highly prescriptive opportunities for us, because I find there's rarely an opportunity I have to speak where I don't get asked something or somebody doesn't trigger a thought that then actually results in a conversation back at Foggy Bottom. But in answer to your question, I mean, it's a difficult balance, right? You know, I don't think that, you know, based on the innovation gap that I mentioned before, you know, I believe in putting tools in the hands of people and giving them the ability to utilize those tools and then looking for opportunities to train and so forth. But I don't think that we are well positioned to tell people how to utilize those technologies, because at the end of the day, depending on the environment, depending on the challenges, individuals are going to, you know, I'm very confident individuals are the best position to troubleshoot. Now, what we can do from a diplomatic standpoint is create networks. You know, rather than investing in individuals, invest in networks of entities and individuals who can help local populations troubleshoot some of those challenges. And so, but I don't think, you know, population X in censored country Y is going to get their best ideas on, you know, how to, you know, circumvent censorship or how to, you know, balance the open and closed versus, you know, from necessarily, you know, Washington. I think they're going to get it from people that are experts on the technology and experts on the local context. And so, you know, there's a lot of focus that we need to have on empowering local entities and individuals to address those local challenges. But in terms of how we're thinking about the closed versus open, I mean, we believe in, you know, we're obviously much more inclined towards the open. And, you know, we're increasingly having conversations with private sector companies about, you know, how we should be thinking about these issues and how we can create more free and open societies. Yes, right over here. Yeah, just looking. Yeah, I mean, I think part of the challenge is, you know, 60% of the world is under the age of 30. They're the demographic that we understand the least. They're the demographic that is the most fickle, and they're the demographic that are the first socialized with high prevalence of these technologies. And so part of our challenge is actually understanding the world's largest demographic and understanding how do they utilize these technologies. I would argue that nobody understands young people better than they understand themselves. So we're looking for increased opportunities to bring more young people into the fold. So, you know, Secretary Clinton announced the creation of a really interesting program that is called the Virtual Student Foreign Service Program, where we recognize that a lot of embassies would like to do more engagement with young people. A lot of embassies would like to, you know, be more forward-thinking in terms of how to utilize these technologies, but they just don't have the staffing for it, or they don't have the infrastructure for it, or they just, you know, they don't have the expertise on it. And so we figured, you know, why not, you know, have our best talent in the United States, who are both young and know how to use these technologies, you know, support our embassies remotely. So we literally had our embassies, you know, advertise, you know, internships. Now a number of our embassies around the world, and we're growing and scaling the program, are receiving, you know, the services of young people who are acting as dorm room diplomats rather than sort of going out to one capital or another and really helping our embassies think through how we do this. Like we have somebody in the Midwest who's working as a virtual student foreign service intern for our embassy in Baghdad. It's programs like this. Again, you know, we can't go 0 to 60, but we're trying to get creative with how we engage and empower young people in this country. So one of the things that, you know, I often say when I speak in a university environment is when I was in college, it was, you know, it wasn't that long ago, but it was still, you know, a lot of these technologies were still just kind of popping up in meaningful ways on the international stage. And so, you know, when people would ask me, you know, what I want to do or what I want to focus on, I would say, well, I don't know how I can become a China expert or, you know, an expert on the Arab-Israeli conflict when people have been doing this for 20 or 30 years. But what's different for young people now is every young person is an innate expert on these technologies just by virtue of the fact that they use them, at least when juxtaposed against older generations. And so that's an incredible resource that needs to be harnessed. So we're looking at, you know, every single university is a de facto think tank and strategic partner on technology and innovation and how it can be relevant or applied to foreign policy. Every private sector company is a de facto think tank on technology and innovation and how it can be applied to foreign policy. Neither need to actually know the immediate answer to that. They just need to raise their hand and say, we want to get involved. And then part of the job of the State Department is to help extract relevant value around, you know, challenges that we face from a variety of different stakeholders that didn't necessarily realize that they had a relevant role to play.
Showing how this can be done. And for example, just our public diplomacy towards monopolies, but as other people have talked about, our core programs, you know, making it more possible for people to go online, look at a map, and figure out where aid money is going in their country, or something like that. And I'm wondering if that's shifting at all in the State Department as well, if that's kind of the generational divide, or the generational difficulty that you're running into, with people willing, not just, you know, not teaching them that putting a budget online in the form of a PDF isn't making it open. You know, putting budget information in the form of open standards and open APIs and things like that people actually access should be the goal.
So we're actually working at doing a pilot on something very, very similar to this in Kenya. It's actually a partnership with Google, where and the origins of this are a little bit different, which is if we want to get information about, you know, who are the NGOs that are doing A, B, C, D, or E, or a non-government entity wants to know that, we sort of cable out to posts and they go around meeting with different stakeholders and they come back and cable to us. What we're trying to do is build out a sort of mapped and cohered platform for Kenya where you can click on, you can literally click on a map of Kenya or click on specific provinces and figure out who's doing what, and have that be something that serves both, you know, the State Department as well as just the open public. And so it's interesting. It's a pretty difficult thing to do. I've actually had conversations with a variety of private sector companies that would love to be able to do this for their own purposes. So it's actually interesting to watch the conversations play out between government and private sector on how we're actually exploring this in Kenya. It'll look like something, you know, in between what I'm describing and what you're describing, hopefully. But you're absolutely right. I mean, Amory Slaughter, who's the director of the Secretary's policy planning staff, is leading the charge on a huge initiative called the Quadrennial Diplomacy and Development Review, which is a four-year outlook on how we more effectively marry up development and diplomacy. And a huge, huge piece of this is how we address exactly the kinds of questions that you raise. And so the short answer is we're working on it. And there's a lot of attention to it. This is an administration that you know, certainly understands the importance of technology as a tool for transparency and efficiency. The White House, Anish Chopra, who's the chief technology officer, just announced very recently a new platform they created, given the importance of crowdsourcing and open competitions. It's actually a platform that can be utilized by people who on their own want to actually develop competitions to crowdsource solutions to global challenges. And so we're getting creative. You know, some of these things will work, some of them won't, you know, but we are adopting a sort of thousand flowers bloom approach. It's a calculated thousand flowers and we're trying to plant really nice ones. But you know, one of the things that I've seen, one of the big changes that I've seen in my 4 years in government is a removal of a lot of the risk aversion that prevented us from really getting creative with how we troubleshoot some of these challenges. And, you know, it's good ideas like yours and others in this room that, you know, when put on the table, actually do get the attention of some of the most senior foreign policymakers.